disqualify myself for this talk because I'm not a public speaker, and I'm probably one of the biggest backsliders around that you've ever seen. God has shown me through my life that He exists, and I hadn't asked Him into my life until my wife and I were going through a divorce, and He came in real slow. I mean, sneaked up on me. And he got our marriage back together. And he's worked many miracles in our lives. And I still was a backslider. And knew he was there. But I got to where I wouldn't go to church anymore. And my wife wanted me to go. And I wouldn't. I had every reason in the world not to go. And finally, someone mentioned to her to let go and let God and just to pray for me. And boy, let me tell you, her prayers work. Because I would wake up, I'd be sleeping in on Sunday morning, and I'd wake up knowing I was being prayed for. And I'll tell you, any ladies out there who have trouble getting their husbands to go to church, just don't you force them. You let God do it, because he knows how to do it. But anyway, I backslid so far that I wouldn't go to church at all. And I certainly was never a person, that if I did go to church, I sat near the door. And but one night, a speaker was coming to our church. It was Dwight Thompson. And Linda asked me if I wanted to go. It was going to be in a week. She gave me plenty of notice, and I said, well, we'll see. And I knew I wasn't planning on going. And the day that he was going to speak, she said, well, tonight's the night. Are you coming? And I said, oh, I don't want to hear that stuff. And she said, well, Denny, she said, you asked me to go to movies with you and you call it a date. She said, you've asked for the last 3 dates in a row. It's my turn. She said, I'm calling this a date. And if you don't go with me, I'm not going to any more dates with you. So I got ready and I went, and Dwight gave a very good talk, and at the end of the talk, he asked a question. He said, if your heart stopped beating tonight, where would you go? Would you go to heaven or would you go to hell? And I didn't know anymore. And so he said, if you don't know, raise your hand. And my hand went up really easy. It was almost as if I was holding on to a big helium balloon. It lifted real easy, and that was something that was unusual for me. Something told me I'd better not fight it if I got that pulling to raise my hand. But I was quick to look around to see if there were any other sinners in the church who... I didn't want to be the only one there. And then he said, if you raised your hand, why don't you come down front and give your life to the Lord in public? For Jesus said that if you're not ashamed of Him in front of the people, then He wouldn't be ashamed of you in front of the Father. And all of a sudden, I'm heading down to the front, and I looked around at Linda, and I said, I guess I'm going down front, because I was pulled down again. And there was something in me told me not to resist that pull. I've never had that pull before in my life. So I went down front, and when my knees touched the floor, I got landed with goosebumps. I mean, there was a bell of something come over me. I knew God. It's just like God had wrapped his whole arm, all of his arms around me, with both of his arms. And I didn't need to wait for Dwight Thompson to come down and pray for me. I got up and went back to my seat, and I told Linda, I said, Linda, I don't know what happened, but something happened. God grabbed me down there. I didn't need to wait for that preacher. And so anyway, it was a month later, I had a heart attack. It's a terrible diet plan, and I don't recommend it. It's not only a diet to weight, but your pocketbook as well. I think the expense of the heart attack was approximately or close to $85,000 total. And I asked for a rebate because God did all the healing. They wouldn't give it to me. But it was on I started getting tired and feeling out of shape. Had no other symptoms for a heart attack other than a pain in the muscle in my shoulder. And, of course, I'd been a carpenter for 20 years, and when you get a pain like that, you kind of, you know, tell yourself to quit thinking about it and get to work. And so on a Monday morning, I'd got up to go to work, and I went in to take a shower and was really dizzy and couldn't hardly stand, kept having to grab the shower head and to hold on, and got out of the shower and tried to dry off and couldn't quit sweating, and thought I had the flu. And I went into the bedroom and to go in and dry my hair, and I told my wife, I said, I can't even dry off, I can't quit sweating. And she said, well, Denny, that sounds like a heart attack. And I go, Linda, why does everything have to be the worst possible thing that it could be? Because if I had a pimple on my nose, it would probably be cancer. That was my opinion of her opinion. So I went ahead and tried to get ready, and I couldn't. I was too tired. I couldn't. I was dizzy. And so I decided to go back to bed, and I decided to take 2 aspirin. I took the aspirin, and a pain started right there, and I thought, oh, I've got an ulcer, and those aspirin have aggravated them. So I even asked her to go down to the store to get me some Atlanta. Here's a building inspector doing self-diagnosis for medical, you know, problems. And she went to the store and got some Atlanta and brought it back, woke me up, give it to me, and then woke me up at 8 o'clock and told me I better call work. And so I called work and told them I thought I had an ulcer and that I was gonna get an appointment that day. And I went back to sleep, and at 9 o'clock, I was dead. And it was real easy. The hard part really was for Linda when she heard my, it's a term the ambulance drivers called death rattle, and maybe some of you are aware of it, but apparently I was making quite a gruesome noise in the bedroom, and she was in the other room practicing her guitars, and when she'd hit a sour note, I'd make fun of her and sing a sour note to tease her, and she thought that's what I was doing from the bedroom, but then she thought, well, no, he wasn't feeling good. Maybe I better check on him. She came in and found me with my eyes open and black, no white or no blue in my eyes, and I was purple. And she yelled, oh, God, help me. And now at this point in time, I would normally think that Linda would probably head out of the house running down the street in a panic, because once in the neighbor's part of our duplex, a bottle rocket was sent through the bathroom window, and I grabbed the fire extinguisher and broke in and put the fire out and found Linda down the street 2 or 3 blocks yelling, our house is on fire. So I kind of used to tease her that if something ever happened to me, I wouldn't be able to depend on her, because she'd be heading down the road yelling, my husband is dead. But she didn't, and she grabbed the phone and dialed 911, and they taught her how to do CPR and got the ambulance on its way, and it took them 8 minutes to get there to shock my heart. So I was dead 8 minutes the first time. And Linda immediately, our neighbors went to our church, and they immediately started prayer for me. And I just want to encourage you people that prayer really works. If you want to see the testimony of prayer, you're looking at him, because it worked. And she had, with our church and Linda and the neighbors, they had me on prayer chains over the entire country, and it didn't take them long to get it there. And I had LDS people praying for me, and Catholics, and every denomination I find out through my inspections and meeting people. For me, I mean, I was a bliss to all of this that was happening, that Linda was going through, the ambulance arriving and everything. I guess I should go ahead and finish the part of the hospital. When they got me to the hospital, they were having trouble keeping me alive. My heart kept going into fibrillation, is the word, I guess. And I'm not up on this part because I wasn't there. And they were having a lot of problems keeping me alive. And the doctor came out and told my wife and family that he'd give me a 30% chance of making it, that they couldn't hardly keep my heart going. And then when my rest of my family left, my oldest brother was there, and he told him that he didn't give me a 5% chance of making it. And so he did the angiogram and found the blockage in the right artery to my heart, and got Linda to sign the consent forms to do an angioplasty. And if anybody doesn't know what an angioplasty is, that's a balloon that they put into the blocked artery and expand it and try to unplug the blockage. And so they did that, but when he put the balloon in my heart would stop. He would back out. They would shock me and put it back in, and it stopped again. And he said he did it several times. He didn't know how many. Finally, he realized that I was dead if he didn't just balloon it. So even with my heart stopped, he ballooned it, and he got out, and then they tried to start my heart, and it wouldn't start. They tried it. They shocked me. He said he didn't know how many times, but it was well over 30 times for well over 20 minutes. And he said finally, he told the guy that was running the paddles, I don't know the names of those, but told him to quit, that I wouldn't have a life to live. And was heading out of the room, and the guy had the paddles charged, so he unloaded them on me one more time, and my heart started. And the doctor said he almost felt sick that my heart had started, because in his mind, I would be a vegetable, and the burden then would be on my wife and family. And but God had different plans. And for me, last thing I remember is going back to sleep with a pain here. And the next thing I knew, that I was looking at the prettiest and the most gorgeous carvings that I have ever seen in my life. And I'm a carpenter. I've been a finished carpenter for 20 years, and I build furniture, and I love carvings. These weren't wood. I didn't know what they were when I was standing there. Now, of course, I've heard of pearly gates, but one reason I wanted to disqualify myself is I've never really known the Word of God or from the Bible. He's given me His words through different methods, but I've never really known it. So some of this, these things that happened with me were all mainly new experiences. I mean, I didn't know who God was, basically, from His Word, I didn't. And so anyway, these carvings are in front of me, and I looked at them, and the closer I looked at them, the more depth of detail they had, and I even reached out and touched them, and they were smooth as silk. And I'd never anything I've ever come across had seen anything so extravagant as those carvings. And I thought to myself, boy, somebody's gone to a lot of expense here, you know? I mean, And suddenly I realized that I didn't have any memory of supposed to be even looking at any carvings, you know. I was like, wait a minute. I don't remember I'm supposed to be looking at carvings. Where am I? And I backed up away from this thing, and it was a gate, and it was as tall as the peak of a two-story house and about 80 feet long. And light was just coming off of this thing like it was a big fluorescent light almost, only it was beautiful. I don't know how to describe it. The architecture of it was greater than any Roman or Egyptian architecture that you've ever seen. And it was too complicated for me to describe. I couldn't even try to fathom to draw a picture of it. But it was beautiful. And I was thinking to myself, now, wait a minute, Dennis, where are you? This is weird, you know. And it was as real as being right here. And all of a sudden, a realization hit me that I had to be dead to be where I was. And the next thing, I thought, I don't have a memory of dying. I thought, did I have a car wreck? I was trying to remember, if I'm dead, what killed me? And there was nothing, no memory of any of that. And then all of a sudden, my knees started buckling out from under me. I mean, I was, and I... I started stumbling. I was trying to, I couldn't stand. It felt like I was standing under Niagara Falls all of a sudden, but it was more, I guess what I, the best description that I can think of to give you for it was being electrocuted with warm goosebumps. They were, it was so strong, that power, that it was just taking all of my energy, my strength. Like, I was stumbling. I finally got my, I couldn't figure out why am I couldn't understand why I was so weak, but I finally got my legs spread out and got bent over with my hands on my knees and was just barely able to hold myself in that position. And not, and all of a sudden, and I'm in a looking down position, and in front of me, all of a sudden, from the left side of my body, around to the front and clear to the right side of my body, all truth about myself was laying in front of me. And I could see my attitudes, my ways of thinking, which ones were correct, which ones were incorrect. I could see instances such as an argument that I'd had with my wife. And in that argument, I could see how I thought she was thinking and how she was really thinking. And it made me realize that in my defensiveness, in arguing with her, by defending myself, I actually created more harm for her than I would have been caused to me. And that to be defensive in that was really unjustified. There was no justification for the way I had been in the argument. And that was just one of the things. I could see my giving attitude. There were many things that I could see. And I wasn't really happy with me. I felt shame. I didn't like what the way I'd lived my life. And I thought, at the time, when I was looking at stuff, I realized that if I'm getting to see this stuff, maybe this means that I get to live, because I need to change these things. I didn't want to be at that gate with these things hanging on to my life, like they're hanging on to me. And I felt like if I could live and change those things, that I could stand in that power with more strength. And again, none of these kind of revelations that were coming to me there had ever been at me in my life. And so these were all brand new to me as far as, and everything I'm telling you is just what happened. I don't have all or have never known all scripture on this. I'm learning it as I tell the story. People bring scripture to me that really, it kind of knocks my sock off that this is scripture and these things are of God. But so anyway, I thought, if I get to live, I want to remember what I'm seeing. So I looked back at the gate and see it was in front of me and down to my left. And yes, it was about a two-story building in height, and that's about 80 feet. Too complicated to remember. Well, I hadn't looked to my right yet, and so I'm and while I'm looking around, I'm still holding myself up. I'm not even, I am barely balanced. And I looked to my right, and the Lord was standing there, and it was Jesus, and I knew who he was like I knew I was dead. And he is so awesome. I have no other I thought awesome was a teenage slang word. But awesome is past description. I knew who he was. Somebody asked me, well, what did he look like? And well, I could remember seeing his hair. I could remember his robe. He had beautiful hands and beautiful feet. And he had this large closed book in his left hand, a big white one. And now I think that was a page that was in front of me out of that book. And somebody said, well, what did he look like? And I do not remember his face. And then one of the pastors of our church had asked me that, and I was trying. I could not remember a face. I don't remember it missing. I just don't remember it. And he said, well, if you had told me you'd seen his face, Dennis, I wouldn't have believed your story. And but anyway, he spoke to me, and I never had read the word to know what the Lord's voice sounds like. And the only description I have of it that could even come close to it was when I was standing 10 feet from the railroad tracks when that huge steam locomotive came through town a few years ago, 60 miles an hour, pulling two other locomotives and a load of people on the cars. And the ground was vibrating and the air was slapping my body when that locomotive went by that close at 60 miles an hour, just pouring the steam. And this thing was so powerful it would vibrate the pins or stakes out of the tracks, you know. That was like dropping a feather compared to God's voice. But he was really sweet to me. And he said, "What do you want to do, Denny? Do you want to live or do you want to die?" And I thought, boy, that's an abrupt question. That's right now. You know, I wasn't expecting to die for 20, 40 years. So I was thinking about these seven things that I needed to change. I'd counted them because they were too complicated to really remember. I felt like the way they were presented to me would be difficult to remember, so I wanted to remember how many. And I said, "Well, Lord, I'd like to live." And he said, "Okay, I'm going to send you back." And all of a sudden, I was gone. He was gone, the gate was gone, and I was floating in some kind of limbo and waiting to wake up. And time was ticking by, and I hadn't woke up. And while I was there, I was even wondering, well, if I was in a car wreck, did I break my neck, or have I got broken arms or legs, or am I burnt? How will I wake up? And I was thinking about all this pain I may have to suffer, but something about it also made me realize that even if I woke up paralyzed from the neck down, it would be worth it to get a chance to change myself. But all of a sudden, I was at the gate again. And I couldn't understand that. I thought, why am I back here? The Lord said that he was sending me back. I assumed that meant I got to live. He must have changed his mind. He must have decided that I really couldn't change anything if I got the chance to live, so just to keep me. And I knew it would be wonderful on the other side of the gate if I stepped through there. But what I didn't know is if I would have a memory of my life or if other people on the other side of the gate would have knowledge of that life. And I didn't want to walk in there in shame. And I mean, he didn't judge me. And I knew that. It was me looking at me. And when you're looking at yourself, you... you don't like it, you know. I mean, I didn't. It was like, I finally come up on a description of that feeling that I had, and I was telling Linda last night. It's like you just graduated from high school, and now it's time to go on to a career. And you've got several opportunities, and at those opportunities, the people offering you the opportunities want you to tell them about how you handled yourself through school. And do you want to tell that person that's presenting you this opportunity, do you want to present them with, "Well, I goofed off and I flunked most of the time, I barely made it"? You think they're going to want you in there? You know, that was the feeling. But God goes, "Yes, I want you." Even so. And I knew that standing there, I was only there not because of what I had done, but because on his mercy and his grace, period. That's the only reason I was there. To judge myself at that moment, I was like an ant. And I couldn't believe he'd even allow me to stand in his presence, you know. And that's what blew me away, that here he is, the creator of the universe. And it was like I was a flea, because I'd bitten him so many times. And he should have gone and just reached out and stomped me. But he chose not to do that. He chose instead to forgive me and to love me. And I don't know if I could ever do that for a flea, you know. And another thing you realize standing in front of God is that it'd be stupid to have pride. You want to think about pride, what the Bible means about throw away your pride? Let me tell you, when you stand there, you don't have any pride. You might as be, it'd be like you looking at that flea again, and that flea drags a little tiny twig over from here to here. And he'd stand there, look what I did, you know. You go, you stupid flea. Anyway, second trip up, and I couldn't understand why I was standing there. And it didn't make sense. And I thought, well, the Lord's changed his mind, and he knows best. He's the Lord. If he wants me to come through here, I will. Although I was really disappointed I didn't get a chance to change those things and know myself that I couldn't. And the moment I made the decision to step through the gate, a vision came in front of me of my wife's future if I died right then. And I could see everything that would happen to her. And I followed it into her future for 2 years. And it would be like, the best way to describe, I could see the emotional trauma, the financial trauma, and the despair added upon the despair, like somebody falling downstairs and multiply breaking bones on top of bones. It was that kind of thing. And while I was watching her future in this vision, I also realized that during our relationship, even our second marriage, we'd been married twice to each other. And when I thought I was so much better, that she had still been the giver and I'd been the taker. And I go, Dennis, you've taken from this lady her entire life, and now you've died and left her with less than nothing, you know? I go, that's scum of the earth. I was really angry with me at that moment, and I hit the brakes. I'd seen enough of that vision. I didn't need to see any more. I was even ashamed to see any more. I mean, it was, you know, the vision went on away from me like a truck going down the road. It just went on like I could have followed it further. But I didn't need to. And as soon as I stopped, the Lord says, are you back again already? I go, yeah, I guess I am, you know. I didn't have any control over it. All I knew is I was looking at truth about myself. It was bottom line, nitty-gritty truth. There were no excuses, no alibis, no denying. It's just what it was. And he said, what do you want to do this time, Denny? He said, do you want to live or do you want to die? And I thought to myself, well, I told him before already. I've already told him I want to live, but I'm back here. I thought, maybe I didn't convince him. Maybe I, because the first time I just said, Lord, I'd like to live. So I thought, I need to be more firm in the way I tell him, more convincing. So I said, Lord, I want to live. And he said, well, just why do you want to live? And I thought, boy, he asks hard questions. And I thought to myself, well, I want to live so I can change these seven things about myself. I wonder why that wasn't good enough. And suddenly a realization hit me that those were selfish reasons. The only reason I wanted to really live and change anything was so I could feel good about myself up there. And I thought, a realization hit me that knowing the Lord, he doesn't go for selfish reasons. He doesn't like that. And I thought, I need something unselfish to tell him. And then suddenly I realized, oh, I can tell him so that my wife doesn't have to go through those things I saw in that vision. I thought, that's unselfish. And again, he reminded me with the realization that, well, that was well and good, but it was still so I could feel better about myself. And I thought, well, with what I know of the Lord, he's going to want something that's totally unselfish, that's not for me, nothing for me. And he's going to want something that's completely free of any selfishness. And I was trying to think, what could I tell him that would be unselfish, that was a good reason to live, that wasn't necessarily for me? And the only thing I could think of to tell him would be that I would live for him. But the problem with that was, is I thought, if I tell him that, I'd have to do it. You can't lie to the Lord. That would be a big mistake. And so I was weighing it. I thought, boy, that's going to be hard. That means I have to change all my ways. And I didn't know if I was capable of changing one thing about myself. But to make that kind of commitment to God is pretty heavy. And I was weighing it back and forth. Did I want to go back and try to commit my life to God, or did I, which looked very difficult, or did I want to stay where I was at? I knew where I was at, but I didn't like it. I didn't like me. Every time I'd get to looking at myself where I was, I couldn't handle that, and I'd go back and look at what I would have to go through. And finally, God again relieved me a little bit. He says, you know, with a realization, it's like, well, wait a minute, Dennis. If you're going to change these seven things about yourself, and if you're going to change the way that you're treating your wife, you're pretty well on your way to living for God anyway. How much more would it take? It broke it up into parts, and as parts, smaller parts, it didn't look so overwhelming. And I decided I would at least have to give it my very best effort. Even there, I didn't know for sure if I could do it, but I knew I could give it my best try. And so I committed myself, and I said, I'd like to live for you, Lord. And he goes, that's a good reason. Like I was 3 years old. You know, like you, when your child gets suddenly realizes something. And I felt 3 years old. So he said, I'll fix it so you don't have to come back up quite so quick next time. And then he said, when you go back, would you take a message to your brother Don for me? And I go, oh no, this isn't going to look good, taking messages back from God. Who's going to... I've heard about them people before, you know. They get signed off, you know, as to the funny farm. So I said, what do you want me to tell him? He said, tell him that he hasn't been listening, but I want him to know just how much I love him. Now, when he said that, and this is a part of this after-death experience I'm going to share with you, that I kept secret up until, what, honey, 6 months ago, 7 months ago? I finally shared it with my wife because I didn't want anybody to think I was crazy. But when he made that statement about my brother, blood came from his arms like drops of sweat. And there, I knew that that meant that there was no power greater than his love for us. But when I came back and I remembered this, I thought, they're going to think I'm nuts coming up with stuff like that. I'm going to just hold it back. Because finally I shared it with Linda. I said, there's something about this after-death experience I've kept a secret, and I'm, you know, I'm afraid to say anything about it. And told her, and she says, oh, he did that in the garden. And I go, where is it at? We looked it up. It's in Luke. It's in Luke. It's the only spot we can find it, where he found out he was going to die and shed drops of blood to the ground. That blew me away, because that was another thing that showed me that that was all from God. But anyway, when he made the statement of asking my brother to take this message to him, I thought, well, that's not the controversial that God loves me. You know, that's not the controversial that somebody's going to put me in a funny farm. So I agreed to do it. Well, the next thing that I know is I was being shaken by a nurse, and she was saying, Dennis, do you know where you are? And I said, I had no idea. My brain was shut off. I didn't even know who I was when I woke up. But apparently the second day I'd been in a coma, and she saw me arousing, so she was shaking me, trying to pull me out. And I couldn't talk. She was asking me who I was, and I was trying to say no, but I couldn't, nothing was coming out. And so I finally shook my head. I didn't know I had tubes down my throat. And she said, you're in the hospital. You've had a heart attack. She said, I shook my head no and went right back into the coma and stayed there another 24 hours. But anyway, then I had pneumonia set in. When I did wake up, I guess I was trying to pull my IVs and my tubes out of my throat. I've got a a real strong gag reflex, and I've got had two tubes going down my nose, one down my throat into my lungs, and I was gagging on those and trying to pull them and fighting, so they tied me up and put me on a paralyzing drug, and a paralyzing drug only paralyzes you. It doesn't kill pain, so then they put you on morphine, and they kept me like that for 2 weeks until I got over and I had pneumonia set in. So they kept me like that. And I had morphine hallucinations, but I'll tell you, they were a lot different than this after-death experience. And where they fell, as I got off the morphine, those hallucinations fell off to the side, and this came through loud and strong. And but anyway, I laid in the hospital for the 2 weeks with nothing but freezing to death and afraid to open my eyes, because on the morphine you don't know where you are. Of course, I didn't know who I was, but I didn't know where I was. I felt like I'd been captured by white slave traders, and they had me tied up and drugged and were going to sell me at the first possible moment to some slavery or something. I didn't know. Morphine will do strange things. There were bees flying around my flowers in the room and everything. But I didn't know who I was. I didn't know who Linda was. One time I was awake and I opened my eyes, and apparently it was Linda sitting by my side, and she said to the nurse, "Oh, he opened his eyes," and I closed them real quick. I thought, "Uh-oh, I'm in trouble." She came and got the nurse, and I kept my eyes closed, and the nurse says, "Well, sometimes when they're in a coma, their eyes will open like that. It doesn't mean they're awake." And I'm going, "Got away with it." So when you think a person's in a coma, be sure you really reassure them and tell them that you love them and that it's okay to open their eyes and it's okay to wake up, because there's a lot of, with the drugs and things going on, you don't know what's going on in their mind. Boy, in mine, it was nothing but fear. The only thing is that I wasn't afraid of dying again. I didn't know who I was, where I was, what had happened to me, but I knew whatever had happened to me, that the Lord had fixed me. And that so I wouldn't have to come back up there quite so quick. I knew I'd been there twice, but that's all I really knew. I didn't know anything else. I had no foundation under me other than the trip to the gate. Finally, the doctor wanted Linda to find out where I was mentally, because he told my family when I had died that I would be brain dead, that I had been dead for 20 minutes, and that not to ever expect me to be the same. So he told Linda to ask me some yes and no questions. I guess I still had the tubes in my throat. And I had a real crush on her. She was really nice to me, and I thought she was really cute. It was like a little boyhood crush laying in that hospital, and this beautiful lady being so sweet and stroking my forehead. And she says, "Denny, do you know who I am?" And I said, "No." I shook my head no. And she said, "I'm your wife, Linda." And you talk about a thrill. Found out that she was my wife. Whew. So, and after she told me that, it was after the initial thrill, all of a sudden it was like somebody flipped a breaker on. That part of my memory kicked in, and I remembered her. And they gradually brought the rest of my family in, and as I met everybody, then it would flip another breaker switch on. I could remember just that part. But I had to be introduced back to all my family members, basically, to really know who they were. But I had no memory of a brother, Don. He wasn't in there. Nobody had mentioned him. And they were telling me how lucky I was that I wasn't totally brain dead. I thought, if I go tell them about this, I'm going to be in, they're going to put me away somewhere. And so finally I got the nerve up to take the chance of looking brain damaged and ask Linda when we were alone. I said, "Do I have a brother, Don?" And she said yes, and I was really relieved. Because then I knew that the after-death experience was true, because I had a message for Brother Don, but had no memory of a Brother Don. And so... anyways, the Wednesday of approximately the third week, I'm not real good on the time scale of this. If Linda was to talk to you, she would probably straighten me out on some of these details. But the approximately the middle of the third week when I was in recovery and had the tubes out of my throat and everything, and I had to learn how to breathe again and I had to learn how to walk again because the paralyzing drug, your muscles all atrophy. And you've got to learn everything all over if you feel like you weigh, like your arm weighs 1,000 pounds. And but anyway, my brother, I shared the experience with my wife, and I asked her if she thought I should share it with my family, and she encouraged me to. So I shared it with the rest of my family. Well, my youngest sister called my brother Don, and who hadn't been there since the first day, and they were very angry at him, thought he didn't love me. And she called him and said that I had a message for him. He wanted to know what it was. And she says, I'm not going to tell you. If you want to know what it is, you'll have to either go see him or call him. So this Wednesday of the third week, I get a phone call. And it was Don, and he said, Denny? And I said, yes. And he says, I understand you've got some kind of a message for me. And I was afraid to tell my older brother because he was the guy that chewed me out if I got off onto the wrong track somewhere. And I thought I was certainly going to get a chewing for getting into this religious stuff. But I had promised God I would tell him the message, so I decided to take the chewing or any other consequences, but I was going to keep my promise to the Lord. And so I told him what happened to me and what God had said to tell him. And I was waiting for this chewing, and there was no response at all from him. And so finally I said, Don, are you there? And he said, yeah. And he tried to say something and started crying. And he cried for 20 minutes. And finally I said, well, listen, Don. I said, my memory's not working very well. I barely remember. I have a brother, Don, and I don't remember what your life was like. I said, does that message fit? He said, well, you couldn't hit me any harder than if you dropped a ton of brick on my head. And I said, well, why? He says, well, at the first day of the hospital, to see my little brother like that, he said, first they said to give you a 5% chance to live, and then they said you'd be brain dead. He said, I went out on a 4-day drunk. And he said, my wife's kicked me out. And I'm getting fired from my job. Well, this is my brother's third time down with his alcoholism. He was a millionaire 2 years before that, and the second wife and her attorneys took it. So this was third time down. And he says, he didn't tell me this that night, but he told me later because he didn't want to put an extra burden on me. But he said, I had a gun sitting on the couch beside me when I called you. He said, I was going to blow my head off. And he said, just before I did, the Lord, he said, something said to me to call you and get that message. And he said, I thought, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to get this over with. He said, and it came back stronger that I was to call you for that message. He said, so I set the gun back down and I called you. And he said, if the Lord sent me a message like that, I guess I better stick around and see what he's got planned for me. Well, then on that Friday, they took me in for the second angiogram to check the balloon that he had, the opening to the main arteries, the right side of my heart. And they were explaining to me that the dye would feel hot and that not to let it worry me. It would dissipate quickly. So anyway, they shot the dye in there. Yeah, it was a little warm. What amazed me was how quickly it moves through how quickly your blood travels through your body. It's extremely fast. It's like a race course. But I was watching the doctor when he was watching the x-ray monitor, and when he shot the dye, his face turned beet white, just pure white. And I said, Doctor, I said, you just lost all the color in your face. Is there something I should be aware of here? And then his face turned red, and he said, well, I'll fill you in later. And So he left, and the nurse told us that my heart had done its own bypass. And, yeah, what the doctor had seen, they showed us the x-rays later, what he had seen was the dye enter and starts to split off into the two major arteries that come in the heart, and the one he'd ballooned was blocked, the dye stopped. That's when his face turned white, because I should have been dead again right there. And instead it goes on to the left side of my heart, spreads into the arteries, the capillaries, and suddenly here it comes filling up the right side of my heart. My heart had grown new arteries from the left side to the right side and resupplied that area. And I was at St. Al's Hospital. They don't have surgery backup. So if it hadn't have been for God intervening, I'd have been dead again. And so a little later, the doctor came in for the critique. And he said, well, I guess by now you know that your heart's done its own bypass. And I said, yes, I do. He said, do you know what the odds of that are? And I said, no. The blockage, given in the, if it comes on long and slow, he said, given enough time, it can grow new arteries to resupply that area. But he said, generally it only happens with elderly people, and even then the odds are 1 in 18,000. He said, somebody your age is extremely rare. I've never had a patient your age that this has happened with. He said, I don't know the odds, but it's less than 1 in 1,000,000. He said, I've only read about it. And then he says, besides that, you shouldn't even be able to hold a conversation with me. He said, you were dead for over 20 minutes. He said, I've had people dead under identical conditions as you for 12 minutes, and we revived them, and they're terribly retarded. He said, I don't really know how to explain you. And I said, I don't have a problem explaining it, doctor. The Lord didn't send me back to be a vegetable. And he goes, what do you mean by that? I told him about the after-death experience. And I said, if I had come back a vegetable, I wouldn't have been able to change these things I needed to change about myself. He says, well, now, Dennis, he says, you know, we see a lot of these so-called after-death experiences here. He said, no two are ever alike. I've never even heard one close to yours. And he says, we have a tendency to believe that they are a hallucination brought on by the lack of oxygen to the brain. And he says, at this point in time, we haven't determined how much brain damage you've incurred from the anoxia. And he said, we need to know this for your insurance and to prescribe your therapy for recovery. And he said, if you keep telling this story, we may have to keep you in here longer for further observation. And I'll tell you, it really scared me, because I knew there was a bill meter running. And I figured every minute I was in there, that thing was just, there was money flying. And that frightened me, hit me right in my stomach. And I was a little upset at him anyway, and anyway, he left. And I mentioned this, I think, something to Linda that I thought that was kind of rude of him, and the nurse said, well, now, Dennis, she said, you are a building inspector, aren't you? And I go, yeah. And she said, well, now, how would it look out on your inspections to be sharing this hallucination? Wouldn't that ruin your credibility as an inspector? And I'm thinking, oh, the pit went deeper. You know, she's got a point. And then she said, how would your employers feel about you sharing hallucinations out on the job while you're supposed to be inspecting? And the pit went deeper. And yeah, it's logic. And I went to bed that night, and I couldn't go to sleep. I laid there for 2 hours, and I couldn't go to sleep. I go, I do have a brother, Don. It stopped him from committing suicide. My heart has done its own bypass. And then I got this logic sitting there. And that was very difficult. Put yourself in that situation. Do you share something like that or not? And I'll tell you, at the time, I was really insecure anyway because of the drugs and stuff they had me on and all the morphine. And I was very insecure. My brain was not functioning right yet. And it's the insecure feeling. And you even wondering yourself, was this a hallucination? And I finally, a realization hit me. If I was really at that gate and God intervened for me, what he did, if he's done what he did for me, why wouldn't he take just a little bit, another little tiny step for me and prove it? And I said, Lord, if I was really up there, I need to know. Because if I wasn't, I'm shutting up. And you know the reasons why. And I went to sleep. I was able to go right to sleep. Next morning, they put me, we went through therapy, introduced to people mostly. I don't think I did anything really that day except find out what I was going to be doing. They wheeled me up to a table by myself for dinner or supper and brought my food to me. I don't know where Linda was. I think they probably wanted me to be on my own a little bit in therapy. Get me independent again. And anyway, the only people really up in St. Al's were all elderly people. Majority was elderly people with hip replacements and knee replacements. And an elderly lady came up to my table and she sat down and they brought her her food. And she just looked at me and she said, what's a young man like you doing in here? And I said, oh, I had a heart attack. She goes, are you the young man that had the after-death experience? And I said, well, I thought I did, but the doctor told me I better shut up about it, and I've decided I better shut up because I want to get out of here on time. You know, I want to get out here as soon as possible. She said, well, young man, I've already heard the story. It's all over the hospital. She says, I'd like to hear it in your own words. And she says, if I promise not to tell the doctor that you're still sharing the story, would you share it with me? So I agreed reluctantly, but I agreed to share the story. She started bawling like a child had just been spanked. And I thought, you know, they'd been telling me that usually most people who'd suffered anoxia or brain damage were violent. And that's one thing the therapist would watch for, was violent. And here now this older lady sat with me and she was bawling. I mean, loudly. And everybody was looking. I thought, oh, no, they're going to think I hit her. And they're going to come out over and find out I didn't hit her. And then they're going to find out I'm still telling the story I'm had. I'm caught. Wouldn't you know, Murphy's Law gets me every time. First time I do it, I'm caught. And she let everybody know, though, that she was okay. And I said, well, hon, what's the matter? And she said, well, I lost my son 2 years ago to cancer. She said he was 40 years old, and he had a wife and two beautiful children, and he loved the Lord. And he's worked for the Lord most all his life. And she said, when this cancer hit him, the doctors couldn't do a thing. Nothing worked for him. None of the therapy. Nothing worked. She said, we followed all the scriptures out of the Bible. All the healing, all the anointing him with oil and the prayer by the elders of the church. She said, none of that worked. She says, he withered down to 80 pounds and died a horrible, suffering death. And she says, I'll tell you, I couldn't believe that if there was a loving God that he would do that to my son. She said, when he died, I lost my faith, and it was as if the 2-ton weight had come down on my shoulders, and it's been there ever since. She said, just now, when you shared your story with me, that weight lifted off of my shoulders. She said, now I know my son's in the hands of God, and that I'm to trust him no matter whether I understand or not. And I thought, well, that's really interesting, ma'am, but I've got to go. Isn't that coincidental? And it wasn't proof. And so went to bed that night. Next morning, they wheeled me in for breakfast, and they asked me where I wanted to sit. And there were a lot of large tables in the dining area. There was one small round table. And I said, over there. Because I didn't want to share that story anymore. I almost got caught. And that was scary. The bills were getting bigger. Yes, but I didn't know how much. I didn't know how much. I think we're paying $3,000 to $5,000 of it out of the $85,000. But so I'm sitting at this small table, and one young girl was in there who'd been in a car wreck, and she is having reconstructive surgery done on her thumb. And I had seen her the day before, and she was sitting at the table with all ladies, and an elderly man come up and sit down beside her, and she picked up her tray and moved to another table with all ladies. And then there was another time that day that I had looked at her, and she saw me looking at her, and she wouldn't make any eye contact whatsoever. She'd just look away and down. But here I am sitting alone at this little round table, and here comes this young girl over and sits down at my table, and I couldn't believe my eyes. I thought, boy, something's changed, you know. I thought maybe she'd been abused or something. I didn't know her reason for having a fear of men. And so I said, well, good morning. And she just startled, like she hadn't even seen me sitting at the table. And I thought she was going to get her tray and head out, and she didn't. She stayed there, just looked down at her tray, was nervously fixing her food. And I thought, well, I won't bother. And then here come another older lady, and she squeezed in. And I had the corners of my tray off the round to squeeze everybody in. And I'm thinking, this is really strange, you know. The older lady, she's sitting down, and she's all bouncy and happy. And she says, are you the young man that had the after-death experience? So I said, well, I think I did. I told her exactly what I told the lady before. She came back for the same thing. It's all over the hospital, and I'd like to hear it in your own words. If this young lady and I promise not to tell the doctor, will you share it with us? And I didn't trust that young girl. And she picked up on it. She said to the girl, she says, honey, if this young man tells us his after-death experience, you promise not to tell the doctor. She kind of shook her head nervously at the lady. So I went ahead and told it, and got up and left, and nothing happened. I thought, see, nothing happened. Coincidental that nothing happened, right? Well, that evening for supper, the older lady come and found me, and she's been looking for you, Dennis. She said, and she starts sitting down. She goes, don't let that doctor talk you out of sharing that story. Boy, that thing packs a lot of power. And I said, well, how's that? She said, that young girl sitting at our table this morning, when you got up and left, she started bawling her eyes out. And I said, how come? She said, well, I asked her. She said she had been the cause of the car wreck that had killed her two-year-old daughter. And she was going to commit suicide the night before. She had gotten a bottle of sleeping pills and had them out in her hand, ready to take them. And she said, God, if you're really there, let me know. And she said, suddenly she realized that to try to commit suicide in hospital was not the thing to do. That they would find her and pump her stomach, and then they'd watch her. So she decided she would wait until she checked out the next day at noon. Wait till she was alone and do it. She said to the lady, she says, you know, normally I'd never sat alone with a man at a table. I don't know what ever possessed me to sit with this man today, except that God wanted me to hear his story. She said, now I know my baby's in his hands and that I'm to trust him. Well, that blew me away. I thought, now this is starting to get interesting. There's two in a row. Third day, I went through therapy and was taking a break and watching some television. And a pair of hands come down on my shoulders from behind, and I look up, and it's a fellow that I do that builds pole buildings in Boise. And he's an ornery character. Everybody in the building department warned me about this guy. They said, boy, this guy will make you or break you as an inspector. He is not putting up with any guff. And he would come in the office to get a permit, and the plans examiner would be nervous after he'd leave, and the girls at the front counter would be in tears. And the other inspectors harassed me, thinking that wasn't it funny that he was in Dennis's area, because they didn't have to deal with him. And I went out and wrote two corrections on his pole building and took a 20-minute chewing. And something about it was odd. And after he got through chewing, I said, I don't care. I said, Jerry, I don't care how mean and ornery you think you are. I like you anyway. And he started laughing. He said, I had to find out what you're made out of, Alan. Anyway, he and I have been friends ever since. And when he wants something from the building department, he comes sees me, and I keep him out of trouble. Well, all of a sudden, here's Jerry, the hands on my shoulders, and I look up and can't believe my eyes that he came to see me. And he goes, "Alan," said, "you building inspectors are all a bunch of atheists." And he says, "I understand you had a close call of death and that you could just kick the bucket again at any minute." He says, "So I brought my preacher in here to get you right with God so you won't go to hell." I didn't even know this man had a preacher. So I set him down and I shared about the heart attack, but I'll tell you what, I didn't want to share that after death experience with somebody else's preacher. I didn't know what denomination we were. And I thought surely he's going to say, "Young man, you'd better shut up about this. You've been hallucinating." Because I thought I had shared it with our own pastors. But their response to me was, I could look at their response to me as one as being, "This young man's brain damage, we don't want to do him any harm right now." So we won't do anything to make him feel bad. But I thought, this guy's preacher, he isn't going to know everything I've gone through, and he's not going to really care that much. He's going to be honest with me. And all of a sudden, a realization hit me. Dennis, you ask the Lord. Maybe this preacher is the fellow he sent to tell you either to shut up or to keep talking. So I decided to take the chance and share it. But who wants to hear that you've been hallucinating when you're sharing your heart and soul? And, you know, and so it's hard to share that. Initially, it was very hard to share. So I decided I'm going to risk it. So I shared it, but I wouldn't look at that preacher. I'd just look at Jerry. I shared the whole thing with Jerry. Finally, I got through, told about the everything and the two people the 2 days before that lost children. And finally, I just know that preacher sitting there with this discerning frown on his face. Finally, I got the nerve and I looked at him to get his response. And he had tears running down his eyes and he's crying. And I said, "What, Lonnie, what's the matter?" He says, "Didn't you know? I lost my 15-year-old daughter in a heart operation 2 months ago." He said, "She inherited my problem and I have a pacemaker." He said, "It's just a pacemaker implant. It's a very simple operation and nothing to go wrong." He says, "She had to wait till she was 15 to have the operation, but she wanted it at 15 so she could go through high school without worrying and have with her friends without worrying about her heart." He said, "She died on her 15th birthday." He said, "I'll tell you, I've served the Lord all my life and so has that little girl." He says, "I couldn't believe that if there was a loving God that he would do that to my little girl or me." He says, "I lost my faith. My church has been falling apart." He says, "It's as if somebody filled me with demons. And now I'm passing them out to my congregation." He said, "I was on my way out to my car to go find another job so I wouldn't totally destroy that church. And Jerry pulled up." He said, "If it had been anybody else in my congregation, I'd told him no. But," he said, "I've been after Jerry for over 6 years to come to church, and all I've ever gotten out of him is an argument." He says, "Then I lose my faith, and then he comes and asks me to go pray for some building inspector down at the hospital." He says, "I couldn't say no." He said, "So I come down here to pray for you, but," he said, "instead your story has restored my faith. Now I know that I'm to trust God and that my baby's in his hands." And it was 3 days, 3 and 3 days, and I said, "Okay, Lord, I'm not shutting up." That was my answer. Since that time, I've met 14 people who've lost children who've all done the same. And it stopped another man from committing suicide out on a job. Has been bringing people to the Lord that I would never I wanted to share the story with. I'll share one real quick with you. It was ex-county commissioner. And this lady had a very bad reputation. Not just an alcoholic, but a person who would drink a half a gallon and get totally drunk. And that she was a man's man. The meanest kind of woman that a man could ever expect to be around, that would put you in your place but quick and stomp you good while you were, after she got you there. She had a real bad reputation. I went out on an inspection and it was the house was locked and there were furniture in the house, and I won't do an inspection in that situation. I can't anyway, but I want somebody there if there's belongings there. And so I left a note and I left, and I got called a little bit later that the real estate lady would meet me there and needed the inspection today for me to name the time, and she'd be there. And so I went, and it was Judy. And I'm going, oh no. And she says, yeah, I remember you, Dennis. She said, you had a heart attack here last year, didn't you? And I go, yeah, and I'm in doing this inspection. And she says, you died, didn't you? And I go, I really did not want to tell that lady. She knows all my bosses. And it was the old fear of the prediction coming true. She said, do you have any of those after-death experiences? I go, Lord, if I lose my job, what better reason than for you? And if I lose my job, you got something better for me. So I shared the experience with her and told her about my brother, the alcoholic, that God sent the message back to, and it stopped him from committing suicide. And she's a very strong lady. She stood there and wiped tears from her eyes. Then she lost it and started bawling. I approved the house, was heading out to my truck. Got in the truck. She comes out there and she reaches in, she grabbed her and put her arm around me, and she said, I love you, Dennis Allen, for sharing that story with me. And I mean, it was totally blew me away that this lady, I saw this soft side of her. I shared that in our Sunday school class the following week. And some people stood up in the class and said, we've got the rest of Dennis's testimony. And these people were the developers of the subdivision in which she was selling houses. And apparently she'd come into their office and tell them about how a building inspector's after-death experience had affected her. And they said, well, he goes to our class, and have you received the Lord in your life? And she received the Lord with them. Then she came to Sunday school, and we had a prophet come through the Sunday school who a year, or 2 years before almost, is when I, after my heart attack, this prophet came through, and I had a real still heavy pain in this shoulder muscle. It wouldn't go away, a burning pain. And I was sitting there, and she had the gift of prophecy and the gift of healing, and I wasn't, even though I hear, now look at this, I've had an after-death experience. I'm out here telling people about it. And I see a woman who's got the gift of prophecy and the gift of healing, and I'm doubting it. And I go, Lord, if this lady is really what she claims to be, have her pray for my healing of my shoulder. And all of a sudden the lady goes, somebody needs their shoulder prayed. Is it you? And I go, yeah, knock my socks off, right? So that same lady came the day that Judy came to Sunday school. And she went over and grabbed a hold of Judy, and she said, you're a brand new Christian, and God's got mighty things for you. And she had this prophecy for Judy, and just, Judy's a brand new Christian, and I mean, things are starting to happen right now. Well, Judy had a trip to go on because she sells real estate, and apparently in real estate, you don't always get paid when you should. It's kind of like contracting. And so she had to go on this trip, and she didn't have the money. And so she prayed. She's a new Christian, and she asked the Lord. Lord gave her a dream that night that in a book in her basement on a bookshelf was a $100 bill. The next morning, it was so strong that she went down, didn't even know she had that book. There was this book. She pulled it out, and to her surprise, was a $100 bill behind the front cover. So she is really a committed Christian now, I'll guarantee you. And but it, things, and there was three carpenters out there on a job that I went to that I wasn't going to share my story with. And they were mean, macho guys. Beards, long hair, cut off sleeves. And when I walked on the job, they go, who are you? And I said, I'm the building inspector. We didn't order inspection. Get off the job. And I said, well, the contractor called me and asked me if I'd do a walkthrough with you to maybe keep you from having a call back. I said, which I'm glad to do. I offer that as a service. And I said, it might save you a trip back after you pull up your tools. They go, okay. And one goes, hey, did you ever replace that inspector down there? And I go, no. They go, how come? I'm telling it wrong because he said, did you ever replace that inspector down there that died? And I go, no. And he goes, how come? And I said, didn't need to. Just, what are you, cutting back? I said, no. And he wasn't understanding. I said, I'm him. And he said, you died? I said, yes, I died twice. I died for 8 minutes and 20 minutes. Another one said, do you have any of those after-death experiences? You walk onto a job like that with something of God, an after-death experience, and you know that these guys are going to grab you by the seat of the pants and nap the neck and throw you out on your ear. You know, I mean, that's the feeling that you have with that type of person. But instead, they all either were rubbing their arms with goosebumps or tears in their eyes, and one said, well, I've got to confess I love the Lord, and I go to church every Sunday. And another one says, you love the Lord? Well, you go to church, well, so do I. All three of them had been working together I don't know how many years and had been hiding it from each other, afraid to admit they all been playing this macho worldly role for each other. So God has been using it in mighty ways. But I'd like to tell you, I know we're getting short on time here, but I'd like to share one more thing about one of my attitudes I run into, if you don't mind. And anybody wants to leave, just walk out. But I the doctor put me on walking exercises after work. Well, I used to get my exercise out building houses, and as an inspector, I wasn't getting any, and walking is one of the most boring things that I could do. So I wanted to get a 10-speed. And I didn't know where our bills were, so I asked Linda. I said, Linda, do you think our money situation is in such a way that maybe I could find a good used 10-speed to ride instead of all this walking so boring? She said, oh, that's a good idea. She says, but get a girl so I can ride it during the day when you're at work. And I go, Linda, do you realize how hard it will be to find a good used girl's 10-speed? I'd never seen one for sale anywhere. So there's a lot of boys' 10-speeds for sale. She says, are you too macho to ride a girl's bicycle? I says, macho's not my vocabulary anymore. I've been dead. There's no macho. But I said, I'd ride a tricycle if that's what it took, but I said, it'd just be hard to find. I said, if I find a good buy on a boy's bike and still keep you in mind and watch for the girl's bike, can I go ahead and get the boys? And she says, as long as you're watching out for me. I said, well, that's one reason I got to live is to watch out for you, you know. So I went to work the next day, and my boss rides, he and his wife are both 10-speed riders, and I asked him, I said, do you know anybody's got a 10-speed for sale? And he said, my wife does. And I said, is it a girl's? And he goes, no, it's a boy's, but it's practically brand new. It's hardly ever been ridden. And start bragging it up. It was a motorbike con, made in France, all the best parts. All, you know, it wasn't an off-the-shelf bicycle. And I said, forget it. I can't afford it. I got to find a cheap used bicycle. And I went back to my desk and was taking inspections. And I'd gotten an inspection that was a half a block from his house, which I thought, isn't that kind of odd? You know, it seems strange to get an inspection so close to his house. As soon as I hung up the phone, he comes back in and he says, if you're out near my house on an inspection, why don't you stop, pick that 10-speed up, and take it home, try it out, and see if you like it. And I said, I'm not even going to disappoint myself. It's, you know, I don't know how much it is, and I can't afford a lot. He said, well, I called my wife, and she needs $40. If you like it, you can have it for $40. This is probably, what, $600-$700 bicycle, if anybody knows anything about motorbike cons, but it's not a cheap bike, and it's got the quick takeoff wheels and everything. I said, I'm going to like it. So just before lunch, I go to their house, and I knock on the door. She wheels the bike out. It's a beautiful little blue motorbike on. I throw it in the back of the county pickup, and I went home for lunch. On the way home, I was trying to think of creative ways to buy this bicycle without removing any money out of our budget. And I remembered a vacuum cleaner that I had bought for Linda when her Kirby broke down. But since I had fixed her Kirby and this vacuum had been out in that garage for about a year and a half, I thought, I can sell that vacuum cleaner. That's worth $40. And I can pay this bicycle. And then I'm really not out anything. I had this figured out. I pulled in the driveway, and here's the vacuum cleaner for the first time in a year and a half sitting out in the driveway. And I thought, Murphy's Law. The minute I decide to sell that thing, Linda is going to give it away. What rotten timing. So I went stomping into the house, and I said, Linda, what's that vacuum cleaner doing sitting in that driveway? She says, I'm giving it away, and the truck's on its way. And I was just about ready to say, oh, no, you're not. I'm putting that vacuum cleaner back in the garage, and I'll tell that truck to move on down the road and mind his own business. And boy, the bells went off. I remembered my giving attitude looking at that up at that gate. I mean, it hit me. God landed that one on me. And I said, Linda, if you want to give that vacuum cleaner away, you give it away. This is one of the reasons I got to live, was to change. This is one of the things that I come back to live for, is to change it. You give it away, I'll find another way to pay for the bicycle. We had lunch. I was bragging this bicycle up, giving her my best sales pitch I've ever given in my life about, well, his wife had it, and she could learn to ride a boy's bicycle, and I would do whatever it took. I would lower the seat. I would teach her how to get on and off. I was willing to make all these sacrifices to make her accept this boy's bicycle. And she was a little sad that it wasn't a girl. So I take her out after lunch to ride the bike, and I lowered the seat and showed her how to get on and off, and she was riding around in the circles out in the street. And the vacuum cleaner had been picked up already. Anyway, she's riding around. A truck comes up the street, a brown retarded citizen's truck. And the guy stops, and he's looking at Linda. And I'm standing right beside him. And he isn't even looking at me. And I thought, who's this character? And then I saw the retarded citizen. I thought, he must be the guy that picked up the vac, and maybe he has a question. And I'm sitting there waiting for the question. Instead, he's watching my wife ride this bicycle. And I said, are you the guy that picked up the vacuum cleaner? And he goes, yeah. And then looks at her again. And I thought, boy, I thought to myself, you give these people something, they start taking extra privileges. And he points at my wife and he said, you know, she should be riding a girl's bicycle. And I couldn't believe my ears. I give him my source for the vacuum cleaner, for the bicycle. Then he comes up and interferes right in the middle of an argument. The last thing I wanted was anybody involved in that argument. That was my very best sales pitch. And I wanted to say, hey, buddy, get on down the road, mind your own business, all right? And before I could say any of that, and I did and I wouldn't have, but I wanted to. He says, I've got one in the back of the truck. Do you want to see it? And Linda goes, yes. And I'm going, oh, no. This guy has got some old junker girl's bicycle. It's going to be rusted. It's going to need paint. I'm going to have to spend all our money on fixing this thing up. I'm going to have to take the motorbike on back, and I'm going to have to ride some old junker girl's bicycle. He goes back and opens the back of the truck up, and it wasn't a junker. It was a brand new girl's motorbike con, had never been ridden. Yeah. Then my fear went the other way. Oh, no. I can't afford $500. And that's what it was worth. And he gets it off, and Linda gets on the bike, and she doesn't help me talking down any in price. She goes, Dennis, I love this bicycle. Oh, I want this bicycle. And I was really upset. I'm going, shut up, Linda. You know, and now how could I afford that? And I was through all this turmoil inside of my head. And suddenly I realized, I go, wait a minute, Dennis. Whoa, stop, stop. What are you doing? This lady saved your life. She was at that hospital every day. When I was in the hospital, my car broke down, my truck broke down, my boy's car broke down, and she still got to the hospital every day for me, stood by my side, had me up for prayer, had me anointed with oil, prayed every day that by your stripes he was healed for me. I have never seen such a person that would stick by anybody in my entire life. No. And what am I doing? If it hadn't been for her, I wouldn't even be there to be stewing about that stuff. What was I doing? And I've got a garage full of carpenter tools that I haven't touched since I became an inspector. And I decided right there, I'll sell everything I got, but she deserves that bike and she gets it. I don't care what I have to get rid of. I'm sitting here with my stuff collecting dust and my selfishness, and she would like to have a bicycle. And so I decided I'd do whatever it took. And so I turned to the guy and I said, what are you going to have for the bike? And I was waiting for this $500 to come out, you know. He starts scratching his head and Linda loves this bike. And he looks at me, and every time he'd scratch, I knew the price was going up. He looks at me and he says, the vacuum cleaner was enough. He says, I wouldn't even have got this bicycle if I hadn't come to pick up the vacuum cleaner. Said I was leaving the neighborhood and a lady flagged me down. Said that she had bought it for her daughter a few years ago and that the daughter had went to college and then got married and had left the state. And said that she called the daughter a couple days before that and the daughter says, Mom, sell it or give it away. I'm not really going to need it. She told the driver, she says, I'm sure you could find somebody who would love this bicycle. Boy, he did. We go riding every day we can together. And God, now we've got both bicycles. And it's something that we finally found that we love to do together. Where before we were always on our separate paths, this is one thing that really put us together. So was that a test? I know it's late, and I do have another tape with a lot of other information on it, but I'm gonna cut this off here and give it back to your pastor. Thank you.
He kept tears in my eyes most of that time. So let's stand together. Hallelujah. Lord, we confess that we may not have categories to put some of that experience into, but that's all right. And we rejoice in the proclamation of the trustworthiness of our God. We rejoice in that, Lord, and we pray that you bless the Allen household beyond that which can be anticipated or expected. And Lord, we pray that you open doors before this testimony, that you have and will continue to anoint these words according to your good pleasure. And we know, Lord, and this is just the tip of the iceberg of the good things that you have prepared for those who love you. Hallelujah. Praise you, Jesus. Hallelujah. Amen.